Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Chris Vandercook is off today. Will they stay or will they go? It's another cliffhanger. We're talking about the future of TMT, the 30-meter telescope, amidst the tough talk and a power struggle at the state capitol. An April decision about its future is put off for now. Weather is top of mind as communities struggle to recover from the record flooding this weekend. We sit down with the head of the office, Josh Stambro. He's learning to navigate choppy budget waters for the city's new climate change and sustainability office as we prepare to mark Earth Day. And relying on the kindness of strangers, we explore what motivates people to volunteer as we sit down with Kanu Hawaii. It's Monday, April 16th. The conversation starts now, right after the news. The state Senate passed a resolution last week that would impose a moratorium on all construction atop Mauna Kea. The measure was viewed as targeting the highly charged 30-meter telescope project. The message is at odds with a recent Star advertiser poll that found 77% of Hawaii residents and 72% of Native Hawaiians polled supported the project. The TMT Board of Directors announced on Friday it's deferring a decision on relocating the telescope project to its alternate construction site in the Canary Islands. Conversation producer Ryan Finnerty talked with Ed Stone, the executive director of TMT International Observatory, about what's behind that decision.
Well, in order to make a decision, we needed to know that we had a permit to actually have access to the site. And it turns out we do not have that for either Mauna Kea or for the Canary Islands. The process involved in the courts and in the various agencies was just took more time than we expected, and so we were not ready to make a choice. We couldn't make a choice because we hadn't gotten through all the process in either site.
And to say that the TMT has encountered legal issues in Hawaii would be an understatement. Is your organization still committed to constructing the telescope on Mauna Kea?
Well, Mauna Kea is still our first choice, and we'll certainly that's still the case. We do, though, realize that there are risks involved on Mauna Kea, and so we first of all have to hear from the Supreme Court to know that we have a permit and a sublease so that we can access, and then we have to, of course, gain access itself and have it supported. So we recognize that there are risks, and we are developing a backup site in the Canary Islands should it turn out that it's not feasible to build on Mauna Kea.
And can you explain to us what are the differences between the two sites, between Mauna Kea and the Canary Islands? What makes Mauna Kea your first choice? And if you did have to opt for the Canary Islands, would that significantly degrade the capability of the telescope?
The major difference, actually, is the elevation. That is, Mauna Kea is much higher than in the Canary Islands, and so that affects certain wavelengths, the infrared wavelengths of light, which have to come through the atmosphere. It means the number of nights when we have good infrared seeing would be fewer in Mauna Kea than they could be fewer in the Canary Islands than would be the case at Mauna Kea, for instance. But they're very comparable in terms of the seeing, how much fluctuations how many fluctuations there are in the blur of the starlight. So we think that the resolution, the sharpness of the images would be quite comparable, but there is this limitation because the elevation isn't as high.
So Mauna Kea is the optimal choice, but you can still accomplish the mission of the project if you were forced to build in the Canary Islands?
Yes, that's correct, and that's the reason we've chosen it as the backup. We wanted to have it in the Northern Hemisphere because the Europeans are building their large telescope in Chile, as are the other U.S. group that is building a smaller version of a segmented mirror telescope also in Chile. So it turned out we felt that for the science purposes that, in fact, it was important to have this telescope in the Northern Hemisphere.
You mentioned that you haven't yet secured a building permit for the Canary Islands. Is your organization willing to set a hard deadline for making a decision regarding Mauna Kea, or is that entirely dependent upon the permit in the Canaries?
We have to wait until we have access, that is, before we can make a decision. And so we need to complete the process If we want to pick Mauna Kea, we have to complete the process and find that we have access to the mountain. But we can't pick the Canary Islands until we have its permit. So we have to carry these things along in parallel so that we have that choice if there's a problem in Mauna Kea.
I want to ask you about public sentiment in Hawaii, Ed, because it does seem like there's somewhat conflicting messages. The state Senate recently passed a measure that would restrict any kind of construction on Mauna Kea, which sort of indicates some opposition. But a Star Advertiser poll in March found growing support statewide for construction of the telescope, including amongst Native Hawaiian populations. How is your organization interpreting these signals, and what sources are you looking at outside of the official legal decisions when you're considering what to do?
Well, the polls certainly are encouraging, the fact that there's growth in support for it. So that's encouraging, that in fact that there can be a way. But it does depend upon the leadership in the various agencies and in the government and the findings of the Supreme Court as to whether or not it's feasible. And that's something we'll have to judge as we approach the decision.
What kind of outreach and public engagement is TMT International doing in the face of these legal challenges?
Well, I think one reason why there's a growth in support is because we have had quite an active outreach program. We have, of course, a scholarship program of $1 million a year, which we have continued even though we don't have a lease. There will be a comparable amount of money that will be the rent, which will go to maintaining and caring for Mauna Kea itself. And then we have a program in the workforce pipeline, and we are very actively engaged with STEM kinds of activities in the school system. So I think that was part of our approach to recognizing that, in fact, this mountain has many things for many different people, we want to be good stewards of our part of being on the mountain.
I want to switch gears a little bit because I think everyone kind of pays attention to the policy and the legality and the permit issues more so than the actual mission of the telescope itself. But can you tell everybody who's listening, what are you actually going to do with the TMT once it gets built, wherever that ends up being?
The large telescopes are needed because we want to observe how the universe began. The very early part of the universe is the most distant part, and you need the largest telescopes to be able to look and analyze and understand what the beginning looked like and when the first stars emerged shortly after the Big Bang, and how they became, how that became the galaxies and stars which we see today. So this is about learning how it all began. By looking back in time, that means looking at great distances. The other thing that the large telescope does is it collects lots of light from nearby stars, which we now know have planets. And if we can isolate the individual planets and analyze the atmosphere, we have the opportunity to look for any evidence that their life has evolved, microbial life has evolved on another place in the Milky Way galaxy. So another very exciting origins kind of study of how it all began and whether there's life elsewhere.
And what would you say in response to the people who are opponents of construction that argue there are already too many telescopes on top of Mauna Kea, some of them aren't being fully used, and your project will be the biggest one to date? How do you address those concerns?
Well, I think hopefully the fact that this is Mauna Kea is a very special place for science, just as it is for others, because it does have the very good seeing, which is what you need, so you don't blur these weak signatures that come from great distances or come from small planets nearby. So we really do feel that this is a very special place for science. It allows us to observe things that would be much more difficult to observe from other mountains elsewhere in the world. That's what we bring to the use of Mauna Kea.
And Ed, if this construction moratorium that we mentioned earlier does pass both houses of the state legislature, is that going to be the end of your hopes to construct the TMT in Hawaii, or will you continue to pursue alternatives or options through the court system?
Oh, I think any further delay like a construction moratorium would be a very serious setback for building TMT on Mauna Kea. It just that would be such a after we have been at this now 10 years. We started the first environmental impact statement 10 years ago. We had our first permit 5 years ago. So we've been at this for a very long time, and I think that if there's a moratorium that says now that we've reached this point, even if we have a permit, we can't build, that would be a very serious setback for the idea of building TMT in Mauna Kea.
And do you have a timeline for a building permit in the Canary Islands? Do you have any idea when that might be approved
Of course, we don't know exactly because these are things which are done by various agencies, but we're hopeful that we will know later this year about the situation in the Canary Islands.
Okay. Ed Stone is the executive director of TMT International Observatory. Ed, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes of your time today.
Well, thank you.
Support for today's programming comes from Bishop Museum, presenting Holomoana, Generations of Voyaging, exploring the story of how an ancestral practice has been reactivated by Hawaiian and oceanic voyagers over the past five decades, now through June 24th.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, developing resilient communities in the face of climate change. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking of a house built in the 1920s on Hawaii's first macadamia nut farm. It was built by a man named Ernest Shelton Van Tassel, who had moved to Hawaii from Massachusetts in hopes of recovering from an illness. With financial help from his aunt, Marjorie Meriwether Post, Van Tassel obtained the land that is now part of Pu'ualaka'a Wayside Park, right in the heart of Tantalus. Its name means the Hill of the Rolling Sweet Potato and refers to how people utilize the shape of the land in farming. At the farm's peak production level, it stretched to 22 acres and had nearly 9,000 trees, yielding around 80,000 tons of macadamia nuts a year. Throughout the farm's history, Van Tassel lived in this house, and today we're looking for that house's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honolulu Waldorf School, now accepting applications for the Summer Fun at Waldorf program beginning June 12th with hands-on activities for grades K through 8. HonoluluWaldorf.org.
Communities on Kauai and East Honolulu are struggling to recover from the wild weekend flooding. The governor proclaimed Kauai County a disaster area yesterday. The record rainfall is a test of our resiliency as we assess our ability to plan and respond to what's to come. The Honolulu City Council's Budget Committee restored money for the Office of Climate Change after much hand-wringing last week. The office is still in startup mode. We sat down with its director, Josh Stanbrough, who will mark 1 year on the job on May 1st. He's grateful the money is back in the budget for now.
And we've really been trying to lay the foundation for, you know, really smart investment in the future around energy efficiency, climate resilience, making sure that the infrastructure we build today is really going to be durable and last the test that we see really coming over the horizon with climate impacts.
Right. And listeners may recall that recently we had the problems on the North Shore with the waves taking out that section of the, I think it was the bike path and the wall, you know, I mean, real issues that we're facing today.
Well, I mean, this is, we always said, you know, oh, our children, we have to do this for our grandchildren. What we're realizing is that this is happening faster than, you know, even many of the scientists had projected. It's happening in real time. It's happening to us right now and to cities across the globe. I mean, other cities that are in the 100 Resilient Cities Network that we're really lucky and honored to be a part of, facing some of the same challenges. We're sharing, you know, what are the best approaches to this. These are cases of you know, fresh impression. This hasn't happened before. And so how do we develop new solutions to it? How do we make sure that we're leveraging, you know, dollars and projects to meet many different benefits and meet these challenges? You mentioned the North Shore. You know, that's something that's not likely to go away, right? I mean, what we're going to see is we know the State Commission on Climate Change has issued a report, came out in December, and it said, you know, we are locked into 3 feet of sea level rise. Now, we don't know if that's going to happen by 2050 or if that's going to happen by 2100. But regardless, we're building infrastructure that we want to last for 30, 50, 70 years. We're going to have to look at those long-term projections and figure out where do we need to reposition things.
Right. And then obviously, too, with our economic engine in Waikiki, you know, what do we need to do? What does industry need to do? What do we need to look at long-term for homes along the shoreline?
Yeah, and, you know, these we're looking at multiple levels here. We're looking at near-term, mid-term, long-term. Our office was involved with the Department of Parks and Recreation and doing some beach restoration at Kuhio Beach that was a direct, result of, you know, increased erosion and sea level rise. And, you know, this innovative new sort of beach mattress that we put in there that helps sort of stabilize what had been some erosive areas and really keeps the beach usable for our visitors. You know, these are not long-term solutions. This is, you know, maybe it's a 10-year sort of thing, but it helps right now as we position ourselves and do some long-term planning with climate action plan and the resilience strategy around how do we really invest for the long haul and you know, change the infrastructure and the platform so that you know, we can continue to survive, adapt, and thrive no matter what comes at us.
And then you were hoping to, I think, double your budget from this first year?
Well, so we were a startup year. We kind of came in midway. And so, you know, the council really supported the office startup with some seed funding that helped get us through the first year phase. And what we've proposed now is a full, you know, what we believe to be the sort of minimum efficient operating budget that would be year over year with a stable staff and with the the types of projects and analysis that we need going forward. So what was proposed in the budget was about $1.14 million as an annual operating budget for the office going forward. We really believe that that's the minimum efficient amount for us to execute our mandate under the charter that the voters gave to our office. Other offices in other cities are actually much larger in some cases. But we believe with public-private partnerships and being able to really work efficiently with other departments, we can really execute on our vision with that amount. And happily, council has restored funding to that amount, and we really appreciate their support for the vision of the office and to really tackle these long-term challenges.
Are there any, projects that you folks are about to launch that would be visible for taxpayers out there?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's things that have been in the works, that people are going to see. You know, there's the LED streetlight program that's going to save $5 million a year in taxpayer dollars, but is also going to be, you know, a safer product, and it's going to reduce our climate emissions by about 15,000 tons a year. You know, I mentioned the Kuhio Beach, project. How do we innovate and try to find these solutions where we can, even on a small scale? The electric bus demonstration that came through, you know, we had a Proterra bus We have a BYD bus in town, and these are all electric, 100% electric. That means quieter streets. It means less pollution in our clogged urban areas. And then it also means, you know, that we're reducing that climate footprint. And that's followed immediately on, you know, all four counties coming together and saying, we pledge that we're going to get 100% renewable ground transportation by 2045. So as an office, what we're trying to do is help coordinate the policy piece and really set the framework for the projects to fit and follow into as we move forward. And what we're doing is we're developing a resilient strategy that really helps articulate what are those concrete programs, projects, and policies that need to be implemented if we are going to survive, adapt, and thrive in the 21st century, given the new challenges that we have.
And then the rollout of the LEDs, I know, you know, was started initially. There was some pushback, but you've got that in some neighborhoods now.
Yeah, well, I think it was a great example of city government working in partnership, you know, with the people. When the project was first proposed, there was sort of a light level that mirrored essentially what the state did on the major highways, 4,000 Kelvin. You know, some folks said we think that might be a little bit high in some of the, you know, the smaller streets and neighborhoods. And, you know, the City Department of Design and Construction, they listened. And what they did is they modified the plan. About 90% now of the streetlights that are going to be going into communities are actually at 3,000 Kelvin, which is actually the same level of light I have in my house. So we have LEDs in our house at 3,000. It's a nice warm color. And I think it's going to be a great project and you know, save a ton of money and a ton of emission. You know, we always say in order to keep the quality of life and what we love about Hawaii, we're going to have to change a little bit, ironically. We're going to have to change some of the practices. We're going to have to change some of the policies that we've long had. And this is one of those changes. You know, it's going to be a little bit different light, but we believe it's a, you know, it's a better project but with the integration of some of those community concerns. And we really listened.
Is there anything specific with King Tides and, let's say, Waikiki and the hotel industry that
Certainly King Tides was a wake-up call for all of us. You know, there's great citizen science around King Tides, some of the photos that folks took. You know, we got a postcard from the future about what sea level rise is going to look like for us on a daily basis. King Tides was about 10 inches higher than where we are right now. And so if we look out and project into the future, that's, you know, a few decades out. But we're looking at, you know, where was that line at that time? And what's the infrastructure we'd have to design and roll in to make sure that our, you know, private and public property and lives and are not at risk from that extra run-up? Because, you know, what was great and lucky is we had those King Tides. Good thing it didn't rain. You know, if you got a big downpour and you had that elevated water, there's no place for the water to go, and that's how you get flooding. That's really what, you know, what we worry about in the long run is as sea level rises, you know, our stormwater outfalls become infalls. And so when the rains come, and lucky we had blue sky during the King Tides, but if there had been big rains, there's no place for that water to go. And that's the kind of infrastructure questions we face.
Right. But on several levels, the federal and state levels, we're also looking at stormwater runoff and doing more to contain, you know, where that water goes.
Yeah. And, you know, we're learning a lot from other cities in our network with the 100 Resilient Cities. You know, New Orleans, which, you know, in some cases is below sea level, you know, they're really pivoting and designing green infrastructure to help absorb and soak up the water. They've got a mantra now that says we're going to work with water, live with water, rather than live against it. And really, you know, that's the mantra that we believe is going to be sustainable for the future. We have to learn to work with water and not against it, because if we fight a battle against water, inevitably you lose.
And Earth Day is coming up.
Yeah.
And we understand there's a big Blue Line project that's in the planning.
There is. Thanks for mentioning that. We're really excited to be working in partnership with the Blue Planet Foundation. I participated in the last Blue Line project, and it was great. You know, we work with kids. We work with community members to get out, get into communities, and really, you know, chalk the sidewalks and show where is that 3-foot sea level rise, bring awareness to the issue. You know, we have time to deal with this, but we have to start now. So we have to make decisions now about infrastructure and location and, you know, how do we build some of this green infrastructure to absorb some of the water and really prevent the kind of damage that that sea level rise will bring. There was just an analysis from the state, $12.9 billion of private property on this island on Oahu is at risk from a 3-foot sea level rise. So really it becomes a question of, you know, what are the costs? You know, people say, oh, well, it's going to cost too much to, you know, change our trajectory and deal with climate change. Well, what are the costs if we don't? And really those costs are huge. $12.9 billion, just private infrastructure. State Department of Transportation has estimated it would be $15 billion in terms of road exposure and vulnerability across the state. And that doesn't factor in airports, harbors, all the public infrastructure. So we're really looking at, we have to invest wisely now so that we don't have huge costs later.
Okay, so Saturday we can all look around and say, uh-huh.
Yeah, Saturday I encourage people to, you know, Google Blue Line Project and register online. We're going to be in a couple sites around the island on Saturday, helping working with the community to make ourselves all aware of what that blue line looks like.
That was Josh Stambro of the city's fledgling Office of Climate Change. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
It's an adoption deep dive, taking a closer look at practices in Hawaii and Arkansas affecting the Micronesian community. Our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat are launching Season 3 of the Offshore podcast that also airs here on HPR. Jessica Terrell joins us this morning and shares more behind the story of the blood calls. Morning, Jessica.
Morning, Catherine.
So our listeners may not know, but there's a large Micronesian community in Arkansas, partly because a lot of folks work there at the Tyson Chicken Plant.
Yeah, there is. It's actually, I think, a larger population of people from the Marshall Islands than in Hawaii now. So it's a very big community.
And so tell us about this series that you're launching.
So adoptions from the Marshall Islands were a big issue in Hawaii in the early 2000s. A lot of women being flown to Hawaii and put up in houses here under what at the time was, you know, somewhat questionable circumstances. But the adoptions, and a lot of them are very good and above board, but questionable adoptions have sort of followed the Marshallese community to Hawaii and now to Arkansas. So we're taking a dive at that and following a young man who is looking for his birth family.
Right. And the number of adoptions is really high compared to the population on those small islands.
Yeah. In the late 90s, the Marshall Islands had one of the highest per capita adoption rates in the world. Something like 500 children were adopted from there in just a couple of years, which is a very small population. And there are no real statistics for the number of adoptions happening today. It's a small number in Hawaii, but it looks like there may be a significant number every year still happening in Arkansas.
And so the concern is these adoptions are happening at a very fast clip, and there are lots of cultural issues behind these adoptions, correct?
Yeah, so in the Marshall Islands, adoption normally isn't closed. People stay in contact with their birth family. And we're talking, again, it's a very country of maybe 68,000 people. And so the Marshallese government really wants to make sure that when adoptions happen, that these children have the ability to reconnect with their culture and also to find out who their birth families are. So that's kind of what people are working for. And a lot of adoption agencies are doing that now. But there are still some things that appear to be slipping through the cracks.
Okay. And it is really a long ways away from the Marshall Islands to Arkansas.
Yeah. And also to Florida, where this young man that we're following grew up. I mean, the question of how you even get in touch with people back home and find out how you start this search, you know, I think was one of his big challenges. But you'll get to follow along with that in the series.
All right. Thanks, Jessica. Looking forward to hear more about this. That was reporter Jessica Terrell with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Treating Trauma and Trying to Prevent It. That's the focus of a summit that kicks off today. Dr. Robert Geffner is with the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma. He joins us in the studio to talk about why it's so important to address these issues. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So this the summit that we've got going on this week, it's really a chance for a lot of professional development across the board.
Yes. It's our 15th anniversary. We will have advocates, survivors, professionals in all disciplines. It's multidisciplinary and large. It's the premier summit for the island with people from the islands helping put it together. We'll have probably 1,000 people, mostly from the islands, but from the mainland and other countries, all dealing with different ways of preventing, treating, or assessing trauma and abuse across the lifespan.
Now, I was just looking at your agenda, and you really touch on a number of issues. It's everything from sex assault in the military, which is, you know, important to address with the whole Me Too movement that's picking up steam.
Yes. In fact, one of the things we're doing this year as part of our institute, both here on the islands as well as nationally, is looking at broadening the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement has really brought awareness about sexual assault and sexual harassment, especially in the workplace and else. We're trying to broaden it to all areas of interpersonal violence, domestic violence, bullying, child abuse, elder abuse, so that it not only has an awareness message, but we actually start the next steps. We actually start looking at how do we set up prevention programs? How do we treat those who are coming forward now and disclosing? How do we prevent this from happening in the future? Those are all key topics we're going to be dealing with all week now here at the Convention Center.
And in the headlines in the daily paper, we've been focusing also on child abuse and the case overload with a lot of our social workers. And a lot of social workers will be attending this conference.
Yes. All the state agencies are sponsoring and involved. They're each sending maybe 100 people or more from all the islands in order to beef up our skills and help really deal with these issues. Especially here on the islands, but also in general. We're looking at model programs, what works, what doesn't work, how do we change policies. All these are going to be covered this week. Two of the topics that you just mentioned, one talking about children, we're fortunate to have Jamie Redford, the son of Robert Redford, who has produced two great films on the long-term effects of trauma on children, will be here this afternoon and tomorrow. We have Angela Marie Packley from Atlanta. Her daughter was kidnapped at the age of 16 and trafficked, and she fought to get her back and others and did and set up her own nonprofit to deal with human trafficking. All these issues are interrelated, and that's what we're trying to deal with.
And we come across various things in the community, locally, and then even out in the Pacific Islands, where trafficking is a big issue, and a lot of them involve like underage folks, you know, dancers, or so it's a real concern.
Yes, especially because they're underage, and some of these kids, just like I mentioned, are kidnapped. It's not like they're all runaway. They're forced into prostitution. They're forced into, like as you said, strip clubs. Unfortunately, now many organized crimes, gangs, have decided they can make more money on trafficking than even on drugs. So it's become a major problem in many states in the United States, including Hawaii, and also where I'm from, where our head institute is in San Diego, another border city where this is a major problem.
And so you've got folks in law enforcement also weighing in, kind of giving the snapshot of this is what's happening, this is the trend, this is what's current right now.
Yes, and dealing with some of the controversies, like how do you deal with the victims? Do you treat them as a victim or as an offender because they were forced to prostitute themselves? Do you deal with it from a criminal justice standpoint, or do you deal with it from a mental health trauma standpoint? These are all issues that people are struggling with, trying to come to some conclusions on how do we move this forward to benefit and help people recover and heal.
One of the things also on the list here is bullying. And we often hear about a circle of violence, you know, and you're trying to break that cycle because it starts young and then it just continues.
Yes. And one of the things we're doing is a prevention campaign throughout the islands where we had DOE and others programs that deal with youth. with an art contest where kids No Hurting Show Aloha, dealing with bullying, dealing with child abuse, teen violence. And so we actually at our lunch on Thursday will recognize the award winners and give them gift cards. The grand prize winner is on the cover of our program, and it's a high school student here, and they get a scholarship. Again, to get the message across that we can prevent this, we can stop this, but we have to work together.
Okay, and this is, like we mentioned, a professional development for folks who have not signed up yet. Can you run down what's available?
Yes. They could come a particular day. It starts this afternoon. It goes through Thursday. They could come on site to the convention center. We're on the third floor. We've taken over part of that floor. And they can register for a day or for the whole summit still. They can come this afternoon and register. Again, professional development or those advocates and others who are trying to deal with any of these problem areas, we have 12 tracks. So we're dealing with all these important issues now so we can start having an impact. This is a major year for us, not only us, but for everybody else. We really have to start doing something now.
Okay, and then you are from San Diego, and you mentioned that our cities have lots of things in common.
Yes, we're also dealing with homelessness, for example, another issue that's tied into trauma and abuse. So we have our Hawaii branch here, Ho'omalehia, Creating Peace, the center here for doing that. And we're working with the local nonprofits and the state agencies, and it is similar to San Diego in many areas. Some of the same problems that are being faced here, like with child abuse, with trafficking, with bullying, are the same things we're dealing with and many other areas of the country are dealing with.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sitting down with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Okay. Psychologist Dr. Robert Geffner is the founder and president of the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma. The 15th Hawaii International Summit runs this afternoon through Thursday at the Hawaii Convention Center. You can find out more on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Kupono from the band Jamarek, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can try and spot in our dark island skies. Tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips, we've got him on the line now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter rising in the east just after 8:30 p.m. It will be very bright and easy to spot. The moon will be a mere crescent towards week's end, meaning conditions here in the islands will be perfect for stargazing.
This week, something kind of exciting. You've got a return with news from a facility we were recently discussing on Stargazer, and also this time around there's a family album of stars?
It is indeed, and it's the VLT, the Very Large Telescope that we visited last week in Chile, and it has created a stunning series of images from young stars and their circumstellar disks. These spectacular images reveal a variety of young stars, each one being quite unique in their appearance and composition. What's truly wonderful in these images is the level of detail that astronomers were able to obtain using the Sphere instrument attached to the VLT.
And what's happening in these disks you're talking about?
Well, what we're seeing is material that was left over from the formation of the star. Some of this will spiral in toward the star, some will get thrown out into space, but most of it will go to produce a family of planets, and each family will be different.
And in terms of the age of the stars?
Well, most of them are around 10 million years old. Now, when you consider the Sun, which is 4.6 billion years old, give or take a few million years, these stars are infants in comparison.
And I imagine this gives some kind of idea about our own solar system and what it might have looked like a long time ago.
It really does. And it's one of the reasons we study these young stars so closely. It helps us better understand the origins of our own solar system and how our family of planets came to be.
And so they don't have any planets around them?
Not at the moment. Or if they do, they're in their what we call the planetesimal stage, just the seeds of planets.
And no idea if any will be in the so-called Goldilocks zone?
Well, it's entirely possible, but these solar systems are very dynamic and things move around a lot.
Oh, we'll count on you for the update when there's some movement.
In a few billion years' time.
It's Christopher Phillips and Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Architects for the offices of the Lili Uokalani Trust, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
Earlier in the show, we told you about a two-bedroom bungalow nestled in the lush greenery on Tantalus. Originally designed by Hart Wood during the golden age of Hawaiian architecture, it was built on Hawaii's first macadamia farm. The home fell into disrepair after owner Ernest Shelton Van Tassel's death. The founder of the company Crazy Shirts acquired the lease and partnered with the Department of Land and Natural Resources to transform the property back to its normal grandeur. After 30 years, the Department of Land and Natural Resources looked for ways to monetize the property. Today, the Nutridge Estate is a popular venue to host weddings and other private events. And we have a winner today. Congratulations to Steve Kramer of St. Louis Heights, another hill dweller who got the answer. And that's our quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Career Center, where students can explore possible careers, get localized data, and understand expectations for those careers. Achieve3000.com.
Kione Kealoha is executive director of Kanu Hawaii. He says Hawaii ranks near the bottom nationally in volunteerism, coming in at 45th and at 22% per capita. We see participation in Volunteer Week as an opportunity to connect our community through the lens of volunteerism, identifying challenges and developing strategic solutions around how we can increase our relationship in this important area of social equity. Chris Vandercook sat down with Kione earlier last week, talking about Kanu Hawaii's purpose of doing things differently.
In general, people are disconnected from things that are beyond what's right in front of them. The cause and effect of our decisions that we make, let's say, at a voting booth, and how those come full circle to impact the things that we do every day, the amount of time we have, the cost of living, access to resources. And so because of that disconnection, I think people aren't necessarily prioritizing their time or their choices in the ways that most impact them in their day-to-day life.
Your task at Kanu Hawaii is to create citizen engagement, and you're not telling them what positions to take. You just want people to take part, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're creating opportunities that have some similar foundational values based around them. We want people to take responsibility for themselves and their community and support others just aside from just themselves. It's think of us rather than, all of us, kako rather than them and me. You know, mine and theirs.
When you say kako, you're also returning to a Hawaiian sensibility.
Yeah, well, I think that in most cases, there's always an indigenous culture in the place that you call home.
Right.
And they existed there for probably a millennia.
Quite a while.
Centuries, millennia in some cases. There's an inherent level of wisdom and knowledge that anyone will gain from being in a particular place over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And to just think that whatever system we have now is the best system is really neglecting all of the experience that the people that came before us were able to unveil.
We've been, actually probably since the Hawaiian Renaissance, there's been a recognition in Hawaii that old pre-contact values had new relevance.
Yeah, I think that a lot of indigenous cultures had a very close and intimate relationship with their environment. And that was both physical, but it was also spiritual. And in many cases, the society that we perpetuate today, it disconnects us from those things. It disconnects us from the value of community. We're kind of more pitched in a competition or a race with other people, whether that's in our general society or in our workplace to get ahead, or, you know, it's just what it is. And I think what we're really trying to do at Kanu Hawaii is figure out how do we see that we have more value in getting together and working together towards some common goals that we all believe and feel are necessary for our community to thrive.
That gets to the very heart of social change. It also gets to the very heart of, you know, the human psyche in a sense. I mean, you're asking people to change on a very people collectively to change individually on a very fundamental level. You're asking a lot of individuals to bring about a broad social change based on a lot of individual decisions.
Yeah, and in some ways, I think what we're asking people to do is to just reveal what's inherently there. I think our current system perpetuates a divisive nature, a competitive nature. It's, mm-hmm. you know, at least here in America and Hawaii right now, capitalist countries is the focus. And how do we return to a place where we're working more cooperatively? And I think when we look back from a cultural standpoint, although there were hierarchies in place that, as in any kind of, you know, large system would have a division of labor, there was also a lot of focus on working together as a community to achieve our goals.
For a few generations now in America, Keone, the whole idea of collective action has been a dirty word, you know. Socialism, communism, this is the loss of individual initiative. Capitalism and the competitive society is seen as, you know, fostering healthy growth and things like that. Are there good things to be kept from that whole competitive capitalist paradigm?
Sure. I mean, I think at the level of nature, we are we're in this egoic competition to survive at the most fundamental level. But I think as humanity, we have the ability to look beyond our individual survivalistic kind of basic necessity needs and start mm-hmm. to be more cooperative. I mean, I think it's something that sets the mammals apart from other. You know, other branches is the ability to cooperate and collaborate, yet keeping people separated in community and everybody having to own their own lawnmower or own their own everything.
It
feeds a certain objective, you know, and that objective isn't necessarily the benefit of the whole community.
I like that, you know, I like that lawnmower example, because you could have everybody on the block. You know, you have seven people go in on a lawnmower and just say, I'm going to do it every Tuesday, right?
Right. I mean, the things that keep that apart are our ability to communicate with one another, our ability to trust one another and work together. And there's a financial piece. I think we're taught to hoard our finances and to pull them inward mm-hmm. rather than spreading them out and sharing them. And I think just the essence of aloha here in Hawaii, we're so culturally and physically related and connected to these ideas. They still emanate off of the land, you know, that I think it might be easier for us to get back home.
Than it would be for people on the mainland, other states?
Yeah. I mean, even in our cities, we still have this culture of connecting with each other, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just people here just, to me, generally seem to be happier, but we're also, because it's such a desirable place, our cost of living and the economics around being here have really driven a lot of our local people to get to a point of like, what do we do just to be able to live here in this place that we love so much?
Well, that's the tyranny of economics, mm-hmm. right? And it tends to trump, social advances. You know, the building of a just society, to coin a phrase, gets trumped by economic battling, competition, that whole capitalist ethos that we've been, you know. We've really got that in our DNA, Keone. Where are we going to get rid of it that easily?
How do we disrupt what's happening right now in a way that actually feels better, that mm-hmm. makes us feel more fulfilled, that we get more value out of our day, that we know that the people we care about or the things we care about are loved and perpetuated and are safe? You know, and so there are ways that people are doing that. There are things that are happening. There's people shooting cars and up in the space to make, you know, to show there's different ways to do space travel.
Right, right.
There's cryptocurrencies which are reinventing the entire economic landscape and decentralizing our monetary system. And these things seem to be coming out of almost nowhere, but they're all around us all the time. How do we tap into these, and how do we start thinking in ways that almost, I wouldn't even say reinvent some of the old systems, they just replace them, you know?
Kind of cherry-picking the best, maybe, of the old systems, adapting them, merging them with the good things about the new things coming along, yeah?
Yeah, and throw in some imagination and creativity there, some mystery of the universe, and I think that's
never hurts,
that's
right?
What it is, yeah.
Do you think we have a better chance of getting toward that elusive goal in Hawaii than we do in other places?
I think we have just as much of a chance of doing it anywhere. I think it depends on the heart of the people, and if that's something that people can still connect to and they want to see that kind of change. You know, it's up to us whether we're going to get up every day and how we're going to spend our next minute. So how do you want to spend that minute? Do you want to invest in a system that's not respecting you or not making you feel safe or the people that you care about? Or do you want to maybe change your focus in a way where you're actually working toward the benefit of yourself and your family and your friends and community?
Kanu Hawaii is collaborating with dozens of local nonprofits throughout the state for Hawaii's first coordinated celebration of National Volunteer Week. With thousands of volunteers expected to turn out from April 15th to the 22nd, Kanu and its partners in this effort are building on a rising tide of commitment to service and engagement in our community. Visit kanuhawaii.org/participate, or you can enter your info to be matched with a volunteer opportunity based on your location and group size. For more information, visit www.volunteerweekhawaii.org.
Aloha, this is Jose Fajardo, HPR President and General Manager. You may have heard that last Friday, we cut short our spring fund drive at 4 p.m. in order to bring you special coverage of the military action in Syria. We felt it was our duty to bring you this important, uninterrupted news, rather than continue to seek the $21,000 remaining on our fundraising goal. Since then, nearly $10,000 have come in online. We are immensely grateful for our community's commitment and support. If you are planning to give in the final hours of the drive or feel moved to do so today, your new gift or renewing gift will help us make up the $11,000 difference that remains on this campaign. You can make your contribution at hawaiipublicradio.org through our mobile app or feel free to call us during business hours at 955-8821. And mahalo for your support.
And everyone here in the conversation would like to extend our deepest mahalo to all our supporters during the pledge drive. A heartfelt mahalo and aloha. That's it for today. But we'll be back all this week with an island-by-island look on how you can get involved for National Volunteer Week. Tell us what you think by calling our talkback line. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And if you missed any of this show or want to pass one, check out the conversation page. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.